As I was preparing for this sermon, I was reading cooking magazines. I didn't know that that's how I was preparing for the sermon. But I had gotten my copy of the April issues of Gourmet and Bon Appetit and Food and Wine. And for some reason, they all had things on barbecues and grilling. And because that's what they all do in April. And guess what? In the end of October, you have all of the magazines doing turkey and stuffing and Thanksgiving. And then you've got Christmas. And I'm thinking about how in the world do these poor editors do this? Every year, these holidays, these holy days in our calendar, come the 4th of July picnic in the June issue. After 300 recipes for turkey, some of them pretty straightforward and some of them pretty bizarre, the editors have got to be going, what are we going to do this year? And I was sitting there feeling such compassion for them until I realized I've got to do a Mother's Day sermon. And not only a Mother's Day sermon, but at some point probably a Thanksgiving sermon and a Christmas and a Rosh Hashanah and all of the same problems and issues, because how do you deal with the seasonality of things, recognize them with some reality and, more important, truth, find a slightly new angle without getting really weird? Because the great danger in all of this stuff from the cooking magazines is the turkey under which the skin is stuffed with snails was not one that, well, I like turkey and I like snails, I just never really thought about them together before, and I was really sorry that I did in the first place. But the same thing happens with sermons and with services. You all know the story of my friend who chose Mother's Day to do his abortion sermon. I thought that was not a particularly apt time for it. You could make the case, but it still seemed a little strange. Now, I've done some weird services for Thanksgiving. I'm sorry, for Mother's Day, Freudian slip. Nobody who was up here today so far has gotten through their readings without their voices choking up and getting a little bit, as they say in French, at least where I studied French, verklempt. I studied at Beverly Hills High School, so I could have been wrong about what language I was taking. This is not something that you do with serene objectivity. This is primal stuff. So when things get too weird, when the Mother's Day sermon becomes the equivalent of the turkey with the snails, we have a problem, because this really is real stuff. Alluded to in one of the opening readings, the origins of Mother's Day. It isn't the saccharine sacrament that we think of that is only co-opted by Hallmark. It really started in America as something pretty radical, as a radical feminist peace movement that said, we honor our mothers by not surrendering to the violence of our husbands, to the violence of society, and not giving up our children easily to the state violence that is war. This was heavy political, Unitarian, and universalist material. But we live in modern 21st century America, where we can trivialize almost anything. And Mother's Day is no exception, but it works because it is so primal an experience. I didn't get through the hymn without being choked up and without my voice breaking. We are talking about love and loss and anticipation of loss. We're talking about legacies that we get from our parents whether they're good legacies or bad legacies, they're still ongoing legacies. And as children, we learn to tie ourselves to things without judging whether they're good or bad. They are just the way things are. I only have one legacy recipe from my mother. She was not a cook. She was an employer of cooks and a firer of cooks, particularly the one Scotswoman who boiled the standing rib roast. But my mother had one recipe, and it was for artichokes. And she burned the garlic. So I burned the garlic. I know all the rest. I know you're supposed to brown it. I know you're supposed to remove it. I know it turns bitter to normal people. But if you grew up with burnt garlic, that's the normal taste. That's what you do in channeling those memories and those experiences and becoming a time traveler back to a time, for me, when I was young. When I think I shared this, there's actually a second legacy, indirect recipe for my mother, which is her chicken soup, which has much too much stuff in it for my wife, because her mother's chicken soup is clear, and my mother's was filled with carrots and dill and actual pieces of chicken, where my wife's chicken soup, they show the chicken to the water, and it's kind of like homeopathy, you know, it's just there's slight traces, maybe. But it's not right or wrong. It is what you grew up with that becomes your normal. And your normal can be pretty abnormal sometimes. I remember my favorite Mother's Day service was one where my mother shared the pulpit with me back at Studio City. And you will understand my non-culinary legacy when I tell you that my mother got up in the pulpit and said, "I want to talk about Jonathan. He was wonderful. He was perfect. He didn't give me a moment of difficulty." Then he was born. No one was confused about where my timing came from. Heredity or environment was discussable, but the source was obviously very clear. I got even, however, because I sang. I sang my Yiddish mama. Now, of course, what makes that interesting is that the minister sang in Yiddish in the church, but what makes it more shocking is that I sang, and the congregation, for the most part, remain seated. One person, as an act of personal conscience, got up and walked out to great laughter and applause, and later excommunication. I find myself going through cycles of how I understand Mother's Day, from the cynicism perhaps that I had in school in Berkeley in the 60s. It's an exploitation. It's the telephone company. It's the card industry. It's the flower industry. And by the way, they do know whether you've called your mother and whether you've sent flowers. And you know who I mean. To a more centered sense of the appropriateness of taking the time to think about what my legacy is, and just how challenging it was to be my parent. I mean, I have been in a couple of groups where people have come up to me and said, "You know, I'm a junior high school teacher. Dober, you must have been a handful." I say, "You should only talk to my mother." It's a hard job to parent. It's a hard job to parent because parenting goes through those same kinds of cyclical stages. How shall we parent our children? Shall it be Dr. Spock? Shall it be Commander Spock? Shall it be Anne Lamott, who wrote operating instructions about her son Sam? the theories change about parenting. Just let them do whatever they want. They'll find their own limits. Clamp down on it. No two children are the same. That's why operating instructions don't work, and having a heart that works and a head that works and eyes that watch and time to spend with our children is the only way that we can really fruitfully engage them and transmit to them our concerns and the knowledge of our values. It's only with time and paying attention and not following page 6. This is what you do with this child. No two children are the same. Not only are no two children the same, but no two children grow up in the same household. This is the triumph of Heraclitus, who said that you can't step in the same river twice, because the river, time, is flowing, and it doesn't stand still, and neither do we. Our children come out differently. We had our only two so far, grandsons, spent the night last night. I would say slept over, but that would be not strictly accurate, because we were in bed reading to Nathan at 11:30 last night. What we were reading may come back in the sermon from sleep deprivation. And Nathan and Jack could not have come out more differently. They're just different personalities. One is cerebral and knows everything, and was at 6 years old was explaining the solar system and the universe to me in cosmology and cosmogony, and he was telling me about gassy giants, and my wife of course said, "That's your grandpa." And he was absolutely accurate in what he was describing in terms of the solar system. And he's kind of the cerebral kid. And Nathan, the four-year-old, is the personality guy. He walks into a room and he owns it. He just makes contact, physical, eye, spiritual. You couldn't use the same operating instructions. You've got to actually treat children as individuals and not just depend on common wisdom and books. The books are resources. And I think, ultimately, that's the model of what all of us are as parents, as grandparents, as aunts, as uncles, as teachers, as members of a larger society and community. We are resources. To our children, when they are young, they may think for a few moments that we're gods because we can read their mind and we know that they were the ones that went into the cookie jar and they're the ones that broke the little thing that was sitting on the shelf. How do you know that? Oh, my goodness. And we go from being gods to being clueless. And we go from being clueless to being semi-smart. And then we become role models to some extent, whether conscious or unconscious, in their minds and in their lives, because they will repeat what we've done with them and to them. And of course we become predictors for how they will be. You know the old saying, if you want to know what your wife is going to be like, look at her mother. Okay, she wants to know what you're going to be like, look at your mother and look at your father. Because we do become those faces that we saw throughout our childhood. Our parents don't compel us to repeat themselves. They impel us. And we have, as creatures of choice with some degree of freedom, the ability to look at our lives, what worked for us that was done to us, what didn't we like, and not just to sit and stew about what we didn't like and not just automatically go, well, my parents yelled, so I'm going to yell. My parents never yelled, so I'm just never going to yell. My parents yelled, so I'm just never going to yell. My parents were authoritarian, so I'm not going to tell my child anything. My parents made me feel guilty, so I'm never going to make my child feel guilty. We've got huge palettes and choices. And always and never usually don't belong on those pallets. You know, obviously, there are transgressive issues of violence that you don't want to do, but I remember thinking at some point in the early 70s, I never want my child to feel guilty about anything. Well, that's one of the words for conscience, is the trials that we conduct on ourselves, on our own behavior. I want my child to have a conscience. I want my child to feel that there are things that are right and that are wrong. I need to represent those and to have the sense that there are consequences and there is forgiveness, because that's what love is about. It's about transmitting knowledge of ourselves. It's about setting limits and knowing that those limits will be stretched and accepting it, knowing that those limits will be on occasion broken and there must be consequences, and knowing that there must also be healing, rapprochement, and that's what love is. And that's what we do as parents, as grandparents, as aunts, as uncles, as members of the human community, to the children, to the future. Being a parent takes courage. It takes the courage to actually think and own our choices. It takes the courage to say, all right, I'm willing not to be a god and to show that I'm fallible and be able to say sometimes, I'm sorry, that was a mistake on my part. And also it takes the courage to not be always a friend, and sometimes to be a parent. But that's hierarchical. That's power. Yeah, we have some power, and we have to own that power and acknowledge it and deal with it responsibly, not just automatically. Most of the power that we have is in making conscious choices, looking at our lives, at our parents, at our grandparents, being informed by what has touched us, what has worked with us, and being open and experimental in how we deal with our children and the children of the community, seeing what it is that we value and seeing what it is that works with them, because they are different. And the more time we spend with them, the more time we get to have to understand what it is that each one needs and the emotional language that they can understand. Because sometimes you'll have a very strict parent who is speaking in one language that the kid just isn't programmed to get. And if you're a good teacher, that's why you have multiple examples. That's why some sermons never end, because the minister is going through multiple examples. Maybe that was one too many. The basic image that I try to use as a man, as a parent, as a minister, is that of a resource. It's not my job in any of those roles to know everything. It's not my job in any of those roles to be perfect and never to admit a mistake. It's not my job in any of those roles to castigate others who are different. It's my job to represent my values, not necessarily all of yours, but to represent them honestly and to be a resource for people to draw upon. I think that that's what we do. And I think what we need to understand in the whole parenting spectrum is just how long moments of influence keep lasting in the life of the world. I will never not burn the garlic. I will probably never not cry at all through the night. I will remember fondly the gifts that my parents gave me of laughter. of a love of people and of politics and of words. The attempt to transmit music, they had transmitted an appreciation of it. And their example of spending time. Because time is what we have to give each other. We don't have to have all of the answers. You know, I've said this before, and in our world, as we live in community, we hear stories of great sorrow and anxiety and suffering and tragedy, and sometimes we just don't know what to say and what to do. And when Nathan falls down and we pick him up and kiss his boo-boo, maybe that makes it better. But there are times when we are dealing with disease, with cancer, with disaster, that we don't have good answers about why things happen, what the outcome's going to be, and the perfect words that will take the pain away. So what we do as human beings in our relationship of parenting to each other and to the world is we acknowledge our helplessness to take all the pain away, we acknowledge the reality of the pain, and most importantly, we acknowledge our presence to each other. The greatest words that we say to our children, to our spouses, to our friends, to our community is, I am here to be with you, not to solve your problems, to love you, not to take away all of your fear, to accompany you on part of your life's journey. And we honor each other with that time and that presence to each other. And on a day like today, we honor those who have spent time with us and have helped not make us only, but shape us and bend us hopefully towards the light. And if we have been bent away from the light, we also know that we have the freedom as grown-ups to begin the process ourselves of turning and returning to where we wish to go and where we wish to grow together.